Is AI fit for the humanitarian sector? Yeah, that's a valid question. But is the humanitarian sector fit for AI? That's another one.
Now, we may disagree on this a little bit.
Calling the next grand bargain the Great Leap Sideways.
This is the podcast from hell.
Grand bargain.
Decolonizing aid. COP26. Big aid.
Humanity.
Humanitarian action takes place at the edge of chaos. And to find the right answers, we need smart, honest conversations. That's what this podcast is about. Welcome to Trumanitarian. I'm your host, Lars Peter Nissen.
Trumanitarian. Trumanitarian. Trumanitarian.
How should the humanitarian sector use information technology? And what is information technology doing to the humanitarian sector? Those are the key questions in this conversation with Pierrick de Vidal, who works with the ICSC in their policy department. He has thought long and deep about these issues and tried to grasp the wider implications of the information technology revolution that we have seen over the past decades. Pierrick is skeptical towards the technology, as you may have guessed from the title of this episode. I chose to call it the technophobe because I once heard him introduce himself like that. As a joke, of course. Pierrick himself would actually have preferred strategic Luddism or humanitarian Luddism, but I think no matter which title we had chosen, you get the point. In good old ICRC style, Pierrick goes back to basics and analyzes tech in the light of the four basic humanitarian principles: humanity, impartiality, neutrality, and independence. It's a really useful frame for the discussion, and I'm sure that you will find his perspective thought-provoking and useful. The conversation is based on an article Pierrick has written, and you will find the reference to that article in the show notes. As always, please leave a review of the show, promoted on social media, shared with colleagues and friends. But the most important thing, as always, enjoy the conversation. Pierrick de Vidal, welcome to Trumanitarian.
Hello.
It's great to have you here. You are the Senior Policy Advisor at the Law, Policy and Humanitarian Diplomacy Division at the International Committee of the Red Cross, the ICRC, here in Geneva, Switzerland. And that was quite a mouthful. What do you actually do?
I'm still trying to figure it out, basically. I think that's what the policy advisors do. They're trying to understand things and figure it out. What is it that I do? So over the years, I've worked on many different subjects. For the past 2 years, let's say, I've been focusing on the intersection between digital technologies, people affected by conflict, but also with humanitarian action and humanitarian organizations, how we deal with all this. So that's what I've been doing. And policy is a big word. It means many different things, but it's basically trying to reflect, understand, make analysis, and support critical thinking in humanitarian organizations so that we can come up with positions, guidance for operational activities or for external engagement at the diplomatic level and other things like this. So we are the critical thinker humanitarian organization.
And today what we will be discussing is an article you wrote for the International Review of the Red Cross called Lost in Digital Translation, the Humanitarian Principles in the Digital Age. And we should say that this is an article that you have written in your name, so whatever you will be saying today, of course, represents your opinions. Of course, informed by your role at the ICSC, but it is Pierrick who's talking, not Henri Dunant.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Yeah. No, I am very privileged and to have the opportunity to work at the ICSC, also because it allows me to develop sometimes my own thinking on slightly more academic issues. And that's the format of that article. So it's, of course, very much taken from my experience at the ICSC and the work I do there, but it's also my own thinking where I try to develop the few arguments that maybe go beyond a little bit what the ICSC usually do or work on. So voilà.
We met at a conference where we were both doing panels on different topics. Yours was on AI, and you introduced yourself at that conference as a technophobe.
You're not on LinkedIn. You didn't even have a picture on the lineup. There was just an ICSC logo. You have a very low profile. Are you sure you're the right person to talk about digital issues?
No, I'm not sure. But what I'm also sure is that obviously I use that label of technophob to just like create a little bit of a tension in the conversation because we were talking about AI. So obviously, you know, that's the way I used to kind of get a little bit of attention at the beginning of the chat. But I'm very much not a technophobe. I kind of don't like these labels that we put on things and on people. And that is so true around technology. And so I think the technophobe thing was kind of there for me to say, like, yeah, I'm more schizophrenic around technology. I am absolutely fascinated by it. I am absolutely convinced that it can bring so much to humanitarian action and all of these things. But I'm also very concerned about some of the trends that we see, what it's doing to people and to societies. So I'm skeptical, but in the good sense of the term. I think we need to ask ourselves questions. Don't take what's happening. There's no so-called techno-determinism. We are not just the victims of technology. We can shape it if we understand it. And that's kind of what I'm trying to do because I'm not a technologist. I don't have technical background, but it's everywhere in my life. It's everywhere around me. And so I'm just curious and I like to understand.
And we should mention that the internet got you back today. You managed to get lost. Google Map took you in the wrong direction to the old ACAPS office, not the new one. So you were a bit late for this. So let's take that as the internet getting back at the technophobe.
But I think it's actually a little bit of an interesting example of how much I love being in the mountains. I need to have a sense of orientation, otherwise I get lost. And I've lost my sense of orientation because I rely too much on maps and apps and things like this to find my way to things. And I just like, and so that's what interests me also is just like, it's funny how all these tools that are bringing us more capacity and capabilities are also undoing some of our capabilities, including very natural one. My grandparents had a much better sense of orientation than I have, and they didn't have these tools. So it's just an example, but yes, I got lost. Sorry about that.
So in this article, summarize for the listener, what is your basic argument? Are we lost in digital translation? What is the issue? You hinted a bit at it here, loss of situational awareness because we have better tools to aid us. But what's the basic argument? How would you lay it out?
So it's two things. On the one hand, I think we are a little bit overwhelmed by technology. It's spreading, it's going very fast. And I think there's a general tendency, and that was very much my first reaction of people in general, but humanitarians also, to be like, whoa, it's going too fast. I don't understand what's going on. You know what? I'm just going to give up and I'm going to focus on my work. Yeah, that's great, but technology is catching up and technology is getting into your work and it's getting into your tools and it's getting into your thinking and sometimes you don't even realize. So we can't give up on trying to understand technology. We don't have to be AI engineers. That's not the point. But we can find our own way as humans, as humanitarians, as citizens to understand technology and try to, it's like, you know, when you drive a car, you need a driving license. Well, when you use technology, you should have a basic digital literacy, basically. And I think that's kind of what's missing. And that's very much true for society in general, not specifically for the humanitarian sector, but also in the humanitarian sector. And I think one of the things that I find really useful to kind of not get excluded from that conversation as a humanitarian worker is to take over the conversation and build that conversation and the language to talk about technology that we understand, the humanitarian language. And we can do that. There are many ways to do this. And I just simply myself found that the fundamental principles, or rather the humanitarian principles, were very useful to deconstruct the technological difficulties, the big problems around technologies. They really helped me analyze and think. And I was just like, oh, it's funny how we don't think about mixing technology with the humanitarian principles. And when I made that connection, I was just like, wow, that's really helpful. So maybe I can raise that. It's not the perfect solution, but it's one we have at our disposal.
Yeah, so basically what you're saying is it's a roller coaster. We can't get away from it. It's infiltrating everything. The danger is that the tech uses us instead of us using the tech. And we need to shift the discourse, go back to basics, humanitarian principles. How do they relate to tech?
Exactly. Tech is a little bit happening to us. And it's doing a lot of things for humanitarian actions. What we are not looking into too much, it's what it's doing to humanitarian action. And I think that's one of the things we have. Also, you know, technology, we know it's dual in nature and it has two sides, a good one and a bad one. It's always the case with every technology that has been invented. You can always use it for good and you can always use it for bad. That creates a dilemma. Dilemmas in the humanitarian sector, we know about that. In the fields, in politics, in diplomacy. And one of the tools that we have to deal with those dilemmas are the fundamental principles, the humanitarian principles. And so I thought, oh, maybe we can try to look at technological dilemmas through that prism.
What are you most worried about with technology and the way it influences humanitarian action?
I don't know if I'm necessarily super worried. I'm really, what concerns me is that there's a risk for us that we give up in trying to understand, because it seems too complex and it goes too fast. And I don't think we can do that. I think we have a duty as humanitarian, a professional duty to increase our knowledge and our awareness and to make effort to understand what's going on and how it impacts the people we work with and for, and how it impacts the things we do and how we do them. So to me, that's really the part of basically ethics and professionalism. And I think humanitarians have a duty to do a little bit better in trying to bridge that gap that there is right now between most professionals and the technological issues.
You know, when I was preparing for this interview, one of the things I was thinking about was, maybe it's just ICC being difficult and grumpy because they're losing the monopoly they used to have. If we take something like restoring family links, that used to be something ICC did really well, Red Cross messages, contacting families. I mean, today you put a post on Facebook, I'm okay, I'm safe, I'm here on the other side of the border, and people know where you are. So isn't it also just us as humanitarians being threatened because we don't have the monopoly, we're not the gatekeepers we used to be?
No. No, I don't see it this way at all. First of all, the ICRC never had a monopoly on establishing family links. We never work alone in the true sense. We are just there working with people who are affected. Always they are the first responders. We work with national societies. So we are part of an ecosystem, or different ecosystems actually in plural. And so it's definitely not about doing that. I think the ICRC, just like many other organizations, we focus on where we had added value. It just happens that within the history of the Red Cross with Crescent movement, the establishment of family links was something very important where we could make a difference. And so we continue to try to make that difference. But if and when we are not needed, because tech can replace us or because there is not such need, well, so be it. Great. That's less suffering for people. That's fantastic. Now, it's also true that while, you know, you mentioned, just because you mentioned Facebook was born as a thing to connect people. Yes, it does connect people, but in a particular way. And I don't think the aim of those platforms are the same aims than the humanitarian objectives. So there's probably also value in complementarity between what these companies or tech companies can do and what humanitarians do.
But I could argue, why does that matter? I just want to talk to my grandmother.
Yes, so talk to your grandmother. That's whatever is more convenient for you and you think is right. If you don't need a Red Cross message, but you have access to a phone, just, yeah, do that. And I think that's also where humanitarians have been challenged. They have to keep up with those opportunities that come to make their work easier, more efficient. And so that's why it's important to, again, we're not here to try to keep up with technology. It just goes too fast. But we have a duty to ensure that we explore how technology can help us make our job better, how to be more effective, how to use resources, the finite resources we have, in a better way. And I think technology can go a long way to do that. But it's more complex than what it seems. And so that's why I want to use, yeah, again, the principles, but also critical thinking to look a little bit further, because there's a lot of, let's say, misconceptions around technology and what it does. And technology is surrounded by a lot of marketing. So we need to be smarter than just fall for the marketing stories and narratives that we get. It's a lot of gray, and we have a duty to look into that gray zone.
And we will dive into the gray, but let's first look at the principles. Let's go through them one by one, and just hear your analysis of how tech relates to them. If we start with humanity, I think that's a good one to start with.
Yes, that's a very good one to start with. It's the most important one. Just as a side note, we have a tendency to put the principles, you know, all together and then separate one by one. It's very important we understand there's one principle that is over the others, and that's humanity. The other ones are just instrumental to support that aim and that goal, that principle of humanity, which is about trying to do everything you can to alleviate suffering and protect the dignity of people. And so, and the other ones are tools that allow us in certain circumstances to do that mission a little bit better. But it's just the so it's a good idea to start with the humanity principle.
Who am I to disagree with the ICC policy division? But I might actually introduce a slight distinction there and say I agree with you on humanity, but I think impartiality is different from neutrality and impartiality, where the latter two are more sort of operational.
You're absolutely right. Right? Absolutely.
Whereas
right.
Impartiality is non-discriminatory. Sorry, right?
That's just a... No, exactly. But people tend to refer to the humanitarian principle as a bunch of things that are at the same level. No, actually, there's a little bit of an order and a hierarchy. Humanity comes first. Impartiality is the second one. And the other two, neutrality and independence, are coming in support of these two objectives. But there's definitely an order. You're right to point this out. Yeah.
Cool. Humanity.
So let's go with humanity. So there, I think... So as always, when we talk about tech, there's two sides. And here, the first side is, can technology help us alleviate suffering? The answer is absolutely yes. There's no question about this. And we need to make sure that we look into, again, I come back to what I just said, like if technology can help us alleviate more suffering or find better solutions to alleviate suffering, go faster in alleviating suffering, we absolutely have a duty to explore that.
So do more with less.
That's one of the things that come with technology. We need to be careful because also sometimes it's a trap. You have the impression that you were going to do more with less, but actually you don't do much more. And sometimes doing with less could have a different impact. So again, you need to look further than that. But on the principle, I think as humanitarians, we have a duty to explore technology and if and how it can help us. We should not confuse that with the duty to innovate. With the duty, and I've heard that many times from colleagues, like, oh, we should keep up with technology. We should keep up with innovation. That's not why we're here. That's the job of other organizations. That's the job of the private sector. That's fantastic. They can do that. We can do that. First, we don't have the means to do so. Let's not dream on. Like, you know, like every 10 minutes, there's a new AI system that's come up. We will never be able to keep up with technology. And also, again, we are not here to innovate. Innovation is not an end. It's a means to an end, and the end is humanity, alleviating suffering. So if technology can help, we have to use it, and if it makes sense and when it makes sense, but we're not here to just innovate. And I think that's where I've seen a little bit, not I, but many have seen in the humanitarian sector, a little bit of a trend to go towards the innovation hype. And if you remember the World Humanitarian Summit a few years back, that's when innovation came kind of on top of the agenda. And there were competitions to, you know, innovate, come up with digital applications and blah, blah, blah. And I think there were hundreds of digital applications. I'm not sure any of them were actually used by people. I'm not sure any of them actually helped anything in alleviating suffering. So that's where we need to keep that tendency under control, because the risk is there is to actually lose the finite resources that we have, to waste our money and energy in innovation that doesn't make a difference for people.
I couldn't agree more. I think I sometimes call it happy clapping tech fetishism, right? It's simply, look at the new shiny thing I have developed. Isn't it wonderful? But there's no serious consideration about what does this do for anybody, right? And how does this link to the purpose of what we're doing? Is there even a use case here? Is it just because you were able to do this new cool thing with your computer? I mean, the lack of seriousness in a lot of what I see being developed is just staggering.
Yeah, and I think that we need also to be kind a little bit to ourselves. Like, look, we're humanitarians. We are faced with amazing, unbearable suffering of people. We don't have the means to do what needs to be done. We don't have the means to address all these needs. So when something comes up like this and you have hope that maybe tech can help, we will look at it with a little bit of fascination and hope. And so it's not necessarily ill-intentioned, but it is a tendency, a bias that we have that we need to mitigate.
Yeah, I think the only softening I would do of that statement is I think we do need to innovate, but I think we need to have others do the heavy lifting for us. And then what we can do is figure out how do we then apply these technologies in the very specific context we work in.
Yeah, so there's two kinds of innovation, right? There's the indigenous, local, bottom-up innovation that has always been in humanitarian action. Since ever, humanitarians have had to innovate. They had no choice. They had to find solutions, build things from makeshift material that they had around, and move on. So I think we are very strong in that kind of innovation, and that's the good kind of innovation. Why? Because it responds to needs. It responds to gap that you face immediately. And so you innovate with what you have to respond to that need. That's good. That's bottom-up, and it's needs-driven. It's problem-driven. The other kind of innovation that we see more and more is the other way around. It's innovation-driven by solution. So, you know, oh, you have AI. All right, that's a new solution. What can we do with it? Let's innovate. That's the wrong way to go about it. We have innovation that is top-down, that comes from the leadership of organization and things, and they're just like, oh, why don't we do this with that? It looks cool. And I understand that. That's a natural trend that everyone has, but we need to manage this because that's not the right way to go. So yes, absolutely to tech and innovation, but let's do it in a problem-driven way so that when we use innovation, it responds to problems that we face, that people face, and it helps us solve those problems. And it's just not innovation for the sake of it because that's not our job.
So humanity tells you that we have to use the resources we have in the best possible way, alleviate as much suffering as we can, not go down some innovation rabbit hole, but really keep the eye on the ball and use tech to be more efficient in a sense.
Yes, and that's not enough. The root of the word humanity is humans, and we need to be human. And then there's a tendency, there's a risk rather in losing the human in humanity because it is sometimes being overly replaced by technology. And so, and I think I always use the same example, but I really think it's an illustrative one. It's the multiplication of humanitarian organizations using chatbots to communicate with affected populations. Look, I understand, like, of course, like you will be able to deal with a very high number of requests and a very, you know, you can just provide information at scale, reach more people, and do that in a most cost-effective way. A chatbot doesn't get tired. It's a little bit of an investment at the beginning, but then it doesn't cost as much as having a teams of humans doing that thing. So that's fine. But then it really depends on what you use it for. I mean, I don't know about you, but when you call a customer service line and you end up speaking to a chatbot, it's not exactly a great feeling. And you don't necessarily always have the kind of attention and assistance that you need. So I think if we put ourselves in the shoes of people who are affected by conflict, who are faced with trauma, with tremendous needs, if the first interaction they have is with a chatbot, I'm not sure that's the best way to go about understanding, you know, their individual situation, that show the empathy that we need to show to them to respect their dignity and things like this. So chatbots, yes, they can help, but in certain circumstances, they're not a magic tool. And I think humans need to stay at the center of those interactions that we need to have with affected people.
I was trying to make up my mind as you described this about what I actually think. And I think on one side, I don't hear you saying that chatbots is like a no-go. It could be a useful tool for certain things.
Right? Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It depends what, but it's not the silver bullet that it's presented to be in terms of managing interactions and communication and engagement with affected populations.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. But I had something else pop into my mind, and I think sometimes these days we almost use humans as chatbots. Right, the scripts that people have to react to, and the way we go through different procedures are so mechanical, and the clipboards people sit with, and then I ask the next question that pops up on my screen, that's almost worse to me because that's not even a human, and that is actually an algorithm you're talking to or a procedure you're talking to, not a human being. It's just a.
No, I think you're right. There's some concern there. We need to continue to train ourselves about what it means to show respect and empathy for people and to find the right way to engage and communicate. And it's not always there because we don't have the time, because we don't necessarily understand, because we have to translate all of these things. But and actually, it's really interesting, but there were some experiments done. And so people were faced with two opportunities to deal with medical issues: talk to a medical chatbot or talk to a doctor. And after the experience, most of the people said they prefer talking to the chatbot because they felt more understood, more attended. And of course, it makes sense. Unlike the doctor, the chatbot doesn't go for coffee, doesn't need to pick up their kids, doesn't need to think, it doesn't get angry, hungry, and all of these things. So I understand the chatbot is that. But we also know, because it's been since the beginning of the creation of chatbots, since 1956, I think it was, there's something called the Eliza effect, where humans tend to attribute human capabilities, such as intelligence or tolerance or empathy, to robots and machines who don't have them. And I think that's also why sometimes, I'm sure if you ask some people, they would say, oh, I prefer the chatbot because it's more efficient and, you know, whatever. But that's also based on that psychological or cognitive bias that is created when we interact with the computer interface. And we all have that. It's just a human thing. That's a classic cognitive bias. So let's not fall into that trap, and let's make sure we keep control of how much and when we use chatbots. But I think launching them everywhere, in most contexts, to just manage overwhelming amount of requests for information and things like this, it's probably not the right way to approach it. So let's be smarter about this.
So the two key points I hear coming out around humanity is, let's use it to be more efficient and be able to alleviate more suffering, but let's make sure that technology doesn't dehumanize humanitarian action.
Absolutely. And I think that's particularly concerning nowadays with the spread of artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence, by definition, is a process that is meant to replace, or rather to help machines do human tasks or human activities. And so they, in a way, artificial intelligence is there to dehumanize certain activities, certain processes. And that's fine. But there are some activities that we should not dehumanize. And I think empathy should not be dehumanized. It should not be given up to computers and robots. And I think humanitarian action should not be dehumanized, because that will affect our ability to act and operate in line with that fundamental principle of humanity. And so we need to make sure that we build safeguards around our use of technology, so that we don't end up, you know, pushing robots to talk to people who need to be understood, who have very difficult and a lot of, you know, take a lot of complexities in their suffering, in their situations. And I think humans are better placed to show that empathy and to sometimes, if you're trained, again, we need to be good humanitarians to do that. And that takes a little bit of training and a little bit of experience.
Yeah, I was actually thinking, what is the problem here? Is the problem technology, or is the problem the industry we have become, rather than the solidarity-based sort of activist outfit we used to be?
It's all of that at the same time. There's not one problem. There's a combination of problems. Technology is also not just, you know, you often hear technology, well, it's just a tool. No, it's not. Technology is a representation and a combination of many different socioeconomic, political factors, and they come together. It's always not just the machine. It's the machine that was made by human that is used or misused by another human. And that affects, at the end of the day, a human. So it's not that simple. All these things interact, and these trends intersect, and we need to keep an eye on them to keep control.
Right. So is that more or less humanity, or do you have more points around that principle?
No, I think that captures, captures it.
Impartiality.
So I'm going to take a shortcut and focus on the key discussion around impartiality. And I think it is, well, that's different ones. Okay, the main one, and then we're going to come back on AI. I don't want to focus on AI. There's already too much conversations around AI. But in this particular case, I think it's important. The sector has been focused for the past 15 years on trying to use so-called, back in the days, was big data to find solution to bridge the gaps that we have in our analysis, to fix some of the the lack of information we had, some of the human biases that we had around analysis of humanitarian situations and humanitarian needs. And big data came as the promise of just like, data can be so helpful to complement that vision and to help you have a better understanding of those things. And so that was very promising. And I think there was a clear investment, if not overinvestment, in those solutions for predictive analysis, for better placement of response systems and mechanisms and understanding of needs. And so we have invested a lot into this. But I think now with algorithm coming in, there's this whole issue of data and algorithmic biases. And that's where the concerning vis-a-vis the principle of impartiality.
And maybe I can just inject, because of course, working in ACAPS, that the whole discussion is something that's really close to my heart. And I think, yeah, there was an investment and there was a lot of hype around data and what it could do for us, not unlike the hype we have around AI today. But what we never invested in, or what it was at least initially a real struggle to invest in, was analysts, right? We had information managers left, right, and center, but analysts, that was something that only came later. And I think for me that has always been one of the key problems in this whole use of technology by the sector. If you go to any other industry, the military, the private sector, you name it, I mean, they invest massively, yes, in data, but also in analysis of that data. It doesn't just appear magically because you have the numbers. You need somebody to make sense out of it. And we never made that investment. And I think that's part of the reason why it has not fulfilled the promise that it had.
So I think you're right. There's even another problem before that. So first of all, the data hype, let's be clear, it was not specific to the humanitarian sector. That was just what was happening everywhere, in every sector, in the economy, in the politics, and everywhere. We were, again, particularly keen to that. Why? Because we are aware of our limitations and because we had that bias of trying to do more with less. So we were just like, okay, if data can help, that's great. But then on your point of not investing enough in analysis, I think before that, we had a problem with just data collection. We don't understand data. There's no data literacy within the sector. And we don't know how data works, how its binarity can be a problem, how its quality can be a problem, how its quantity can be a problem. And so we were launched in this. So it was just like, okay, let's just collect data as much as we can. We'll figure out later what we do. That's a catastrophe. That's a catastrophe because it's completely not in line with the principles of data protection. And I think if there was a key lessons to be learned from the big data experience is data minimization. Just get what you need. Make sure you understand that you know why you're going for a certain type of data and you can keep control of that, because otherwise you're overwhelmed in not only analyzing it, but just in managing it. And it gets lost and it doesn't get updated and it doesn't get curated and it doesn't get deleted. And then that's a massive liability issue in terms of data protection, in terms of cybersecurity, and in terms of your ability to make sense of it. And so, and we've seen in other sectors also how it's called big data turn into bad data, as in you're just completely overwhelmed by it. It's not good quality and it's going to lead you to wrong solutions or wrong interpretations. So we need to probably find a better balance. But to me, the lessons there is, it's of course, we need to invest in the ability to analyze, as you rightly said. But I think first step is we need to invest in our data literacy. We need to make sure that humanitarians for whom data is so key actually understand what is data, how it works, and what are the limits and the opportunities around it.
Yeah, and I might even take it a step further back and say we have to focus on decision making. What are you actually trying to change? What are you going to use that data for? And I think we have a great tendency to separate data collection, analysis, whatever, from the actual decision making. And those two processes seem to operate pretty much in isolation of each other.
Absolutely. And that's where we come back to the conversation on solution-driven versus problem-driven. Solution-driven was big data is the solution to your problems. Just go collect data, we'll figure it out, and we'll find a solution. That's not right. The first step is actually, what is exactly your problem? What are you trying to figure out? What are you trying to understand? What is your gap of knowledge and analysis and information? And only then you know what is the kind of data that you need to go to. And only then you can actually manage it because it's not overwhelming and because it makes sense. And then the analysis would be much easier. So, and there's this tendency, you know, in I don't know, like people, when you come, it's just like very often just like, I don't want to hear about problems. I want to hear about solutions. yeah, great. But if you don't know what your problem is, how are you going to find the right solution? And I think that was very much the case with data and big data.
We boiled it down to three golden rules that sort of guide our work. Rule number one, know what you need to know, right? So have clarity on what your decision maker needs to know. Rule number two, make sense, not data. So if you're collecting data, but you don't know why, stop doing that and figuring out what's your analytical framework. And number three, don't be precisely wrong, be approximately right. So when you work in the sort of situations we work in, very complex, fast-moving, ambiguous, high level of precision turns into an outdated snapshot in 2 days flat. And that good enough analysis that you need, that sweet spot you need to hit about being approximately right, that's really key. And that is very difficult in a risk-averse sector such as ours.
Yes. And I think also there was maybe over the past few years, for different reasons, an over-focus on the quantitative aspects of what we do. A lot of questions on humanitarians know to show that they are effective, impactful, and these are good questions, legitimate questions. But I think the tendency was to respond to those questions with data and quantitative measurements, which are very important, but they are not enough. They are only half of the picture. And I think the qualitative analysis that used to be very much at the center of things is has kind of been overwhelmed by the quantitative elements, and we need to probably find a better balance. So absolutely yes to data, absolutely yes to quantitative elements, but they are not enough. And if you don't want them to bias your analysis and understanding, you need to bring qualitative analysis and assessment in there.
Yeah. I'm wondering whether to go into this because it's a
long discussion. We're going far away.
But let me have a quick go at it. Yes and no. Right? There's nothing more annoying than some humanitarian telling a little pretty poetry story based on a short trip to a random village where he or she went for 2 hours, and then that becomes the foundation for an assessment. That's just not professional. There's nothing worse than some geek who has constructed a dashboard that's supposed to tell you how to prioritize between 2,000 villages in Pakistan without ever understanding the reality of those villages. It's just heartless, cold stupidity and wrong, right?
Yes.
But what we need is a mixed methods approach.
Absolutely. That's what I meant by balancing the two. Because the first, the story you mentioned of the person who's able to do nice storytelling coming back from an anecdotal 3 days trip somewhere and tells you, I understand the humanitarian problems. Yeah, no, that doesn't work. That's not right. And it's good when we can counter check this perspective with data, because that helps us to identify and reduce our human biases. Now, let's do the same with data biases and algorithmic biases. Can we? Most of the time we can. We cannot, because we don't understand those biases. We don't have a clear understanding of how does data interact, of how algorithms work, because we can't open the black box. And so you're not able to make an explanation of what potential biases come into the picture, how you mitigate them, how you redress them. That's much easier to some extent with human biases, because we know them. They are documented by psychology, by sociology, by all of these things. And we also have a lot of human experience, humanitarian experience. So by now we know the traps we systematically fall into, and we should be able to manage them with better use of other sources of information, quantitative information and data. So it's all a very much an equilibrium exercise. But I think we have a tendency to move from one extreme to other in another. And for way too long, we were purely in the qualitative. That was really not enough and sufficient and satisfactory. And then we moved to the overly quantitative and data-driven. And I think that's also not right. So let's go towards a balance.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. And what I hear you saying on impartiality is, on one side, we thought big data was going to solve the problem. It didn't. We have probably swung too far on the quantitative side. I would argue we probably did not have enough human resources to really leverage the big data in the way it should have been, especially in very uneven information spaces such as the one we operate with in the humanitarian sector. And then the last thing you bring out here is that the big problem with AI is that there we don't even see the biases. We just get the result coming out of the machine. You push the button, the result come out. You actually don't know how it worked.
Exactly. And I think there it's very much linked. So impartiality is this whole point of being able to explain why the responses you provide are positioned in a particular place vis-a-vis a particular type of population, vis-a-vis a particular type of need. And that needs to be done without discrimination based on any potential consideration. And so that's what impartiality is. In order to be faithful to the principle of impartiality, you also need to be accountable, which means you need to be able to explain how you measured, how you took that decision, how you came up with the prioritization, and how you organized your response accordingly. Nowadays, with the introduction of AI-driven systems in the analysis of needs or the design of programmatic responses, this is done by a mathematical formula that is an algorithm that we haven't built. It is based on the use of data that we have maybe collected, maybe not. We can't open that box most of the time because it's commercial and it belongs to companies that protect them because these are their assets. And so if you can open that box, you're not able to explain the relationship between the input and the output. And when you do that, you lose your ability to explain how you respected the principle of impartiality. And we also know that it's very well documented. AI has a huge bias problem. And it's always the same bias. It's always the same discrimination because we talk about algorithmic biases, but what are they? They are discriminations. They are forms of discrimination, and they affect, of course, disproportionately women, disproportionately people of color, and all of it and all of that. So I think instead of it's already highly complex to try to be faithful to the principle of impartiality. I think if we systematically add these algorithmic biases in the work we do and our assessment, it's going to become a nightmare and it's going to become impossible to be faithful to that principle, but also to be accountable, to explain how and why we do things. And that's probably not a good thing for humanitarians. We know we have a problem with accountability. We're making efforts. And I think AI has the potential, because it can also be done the right way, but the potential to make that impartiality objective and ambition more difficult to achieve.
So when you spoke about humanity, you were like, okay, it can help us be more efficient and help more people, so that's good, but we have to be careful that we don't dehumanize. On impartiality, all I hear you saying is, it'll get worse.
Not necessarily, because I think I hope, with the amount of billions, not millions, billions that are being invested by tech companies and so on and so forth in the AI world, I hope we can eventually get there where we have ways to better identify the problems with the famous, you know, the problems with the data. So the garbage in, garbage out problem that comes with algorithms. And I also hope that the ability of AI engineer to understand themselves, how the algorithm that they've created work and interact and create, move from input to output is going to improve. So I don't think it's necessarily a lost battle. I'm just saying we're not there yet. And if we're not there yet, then maybe we should be more prudent about using these tools. And it's also the same, like, you know, people are just like, oh, is AI fit for the humanitarian sector? Yeah, that's a valid question. But is the humanitarian sector fit for AI? That's another one. We always have had a problem with data. Data is the root of AI systems. And if we don't manage that problem, we will face more problems because AI are going to amplify, multiply and accelerate those problems, and our ability to manage them is limited.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think the fundamental problem we have is the relationship between data, evidence, decision-making, and accountability of that decision-making. That's messed up the way it is right now. And the problem, as you say, is if you then sprinkle some AI on top of that, making the actual decisions invisible, or actually there is no decision, just a result, right? There's only one way to do this. Then that will just make it worse. But the fundamental problem is that we're not in great shape today.
Exactly. And I think that's also the point is to say maybe we need to be a little bit more strategically patient about using all these technologies, because we need to be in a better position to understand and control them. And right now, I think the gap is really a little bit problematic. So let's work on our data and digital literacy. Let's work on focusing where really we know AI can make a big difference. And let's refrain from using them where we're not sure And when we're not sure we are able to manage those things responsibly. And I think that's where we also have another duty. So duty to explore technology, yes, but duty to do that responsibly and ethically. And if you cannot do that responsibly and ethically, probably better not to do it at all.
Maybe just to be a bit of a contrarian.
Please.
You know, we're going to be faced with a significant increase in needs in coming decades. I think we can all see that. Just climate change alone will drive a significantly higher number of people to be displaced and be on the move. We have this do no harm principle we talk about. Maybe it's time to replace that with sort of a net positive sort of way of thinking about things, right? I mean, if AI really can help us do so much more and reach so many more people by really scaling our interventions, you know, because I don't think what we do today is really scalable. Right? And so you sit there in your corner and say, oh, we must be ethical, but you don't scale. Isn't it unethical not to meet the challenge, and shouldn't we take off the gloves and start focusing on net positive?
So it can be. So first of all, I want to be contrarian to your contrarianism. No, it's the first thing. I'm just like, this increase in needs, yes, because we, without being doom and gloom, it's really scary and concerning where we are right now. And when you open your eyes in the morning, look at the newspaper or whatever, it's just really, really scary. So I think it's right to be afraid of that massive increase in needs, in particular also because of the combination of different factors. International conflicts are back, violence is maintained at least the same level than before, if not more, and then climate change, which is going to be a major amplifier of vulnerabilities and suffering. So absolutely in that. But when was the last time that you heard the humanitarian sector saying that humanitarian needs were decreasing? Never happened. And so it's also part of a legitimate humanitarian narrative to come and just like, needs are increasing. And I think it's right, because we want to raise awareness of the needs to do more for people who suffer. But at the same time, we need to be also able to identify when this increase is due to different factors, a complex multiplicity of factors. And voila. So that was just on the point of increasing needs. But I think generally speaking, it's very true. On the do no harm, versus, well, how do you call it? Net positive. So first of all, do no harm. Let's deconstruct that one too. we love it, right? It's really something identitarian in the sector. And I think that's great. But we do harm. Every single humanitarian action does harm to some extent, to someone, somewhere. Hopefully it's not much harm. And I think what we mean by do no harm is actually do as little harm as you can and mitigate that harm the best you can. But I think that's a completely different approach than coming in, you know, with the humanitarian toolbox and saying like, well, we're here, we're good because we do no harm. It's more complex than that. And we need to be humble in that vis-a-vis that. So it's good as an aspirational goal to do no harm, but it's more complicated and sophisticated than that. In reality, we need to be aware of that reality, and it's something very important. And on the net positive, then we come back to who's doing it. So I think like there are different kind of humanitarian responses, right? It's like the humanitarian sector is a combination of different ecosystems. Some actors are so-called principled. Others are not. Some abide by the principle of neutrality and independence. Others do not. It's not a question of who's the best. Whoever can respond and provide responses to needs and alleviate the suffering of people, that's great. If we can combine those different ecosystems and those different approaches and responses, that's fantastic. Why? Because it responds to the first principle, which everyone has in common, which is humanity. Alleviate that suffering. So I think we should see it this way, as a combination of things. Now, if the private sector or the tech companies wants to chip in and also contribute to that because they have the ability to respond at scale, well, so be it, fine. They can also contribute and do their things. But it is not the same than the humanitarian response that we are working on, because we have to be principled. We have to abide by those principles. Why? Because we are operating in situations that absolutely require it. We don't do it because we like it. We do it because we have no choice. You want to operate on both sides of the front lines? Well, try not to be independent. That will make it impossible. You want to reach out, you know, in very polarized settings, different communities, you have to be neutral, because if you're not, you won't get there. And if you do, you probably will be in danger. So there are these different elements. And I think the net positive is one consideration. yes, let's not be overly utilitarian. Sometimes it's not to how much needs you respond, but also how you respond to those needs, who is getting it, and how it's reaching there, and how we do this. So yeah, let's avoid this overly simplistic, do no harm, but net positive, probably both things that are useful to keep in mind, but overly simplistic.
Yeah, but what I also hear you saying is that it actually might be useful to have some less principled actors do some of the heavy lifting, and then the principled ones, such as ICC, can pick up some of the residual needs.
It's all of that is true at the same time. There are some situations where the ICRC will not be needed because others are doing the job and they're doing according to their own principles or their own methodologies, and that can also be fine. And if there are no needs for us to come in, well, so be it. But we know over 160 years of history that there are always places where you need neutral, independent, impartial actors to come in because the situation is too complicated and polarized. And local actors don't have the ability to reach everyone or to go beyond frontline and things like this. So let's also not throw the humanitarian principle action, you know, away. It is still very relevant, unfortunately, I want to say. But it's still very relevant. And so different kind of responses can coexist within the humanitarian ecosystems. And I think principled humanitarian action is still a very important one. And we see it nowadays with the return of international armed conflict, where I think neutral, impartial, independent humanitarian actors are the only one who will be able to, maybe not the only one, but definitely can make a difference.
Mm. Good. Neutrality.
Neutrality. So we're getting now, it's slightly more complex with neutrality and independence. So neutrality, it's about not taking sides. Too simple, to oversimplify again, between parties to a conflict or in a political debate or things like that. Now, what we have a tendency, and we come back to the beginning of the conversation, a lot of people say, oh, it's just technology, it's a tool. It's like a hammer, it's just a tool, it depends what you do. Well, no, it's slightly more complicated than that. Technology is not good or bad in and of itself, but it's also not neutral. So when you want to reach, when you have neutrality as a guiding principle of your action and you play or you use something that is by definition not neutral, already there's a tension. The problem is not being aware of that tension. And I think too many people think that technology is neutral, and it's not. Technology by definition, it represents the values of those who create it, those who design it, those who develop it, those who use it, those who promote it and fund it, and so on and so forth. And these values can be good values, they can be less good values, but they are sometimes politically motivated and politically interested. And so let's not be naive about technology. And it's particularly true today about AI. You see the international so-called race for AI, where private companies, states are competing for the control of the whole supply chain behind it, the data, the microchips and all of this. So tech is about power and it's politics. So we need to relate to technology as we relate to politics.
So what are you saying? Is it a problem if I have a Mac or a PC that sends different signals? Or what are we talking about?
So not necessarily, but it could be. It could be now and it could be in the future. So the first point is technology companies used to be mostly that, commercial companies driven by profit, like all other private sector companies. But nowadays, if you read the newspapers, you see them and you see their behavior and their posture, and they're moving a little bit away from that. And they are more and more active in the political sphere. They are taking position on societal debates, mental health, protection of data, you know, trust and monopolies and things like this. They're also taking positions on international issues, politics, security, and conflict. And so now we're actually dealing with companies that are providers of the technology we use, but that are at the same time political actors and sometimes conflict actors. And that completely transformed the way we should relate to them according to the principle of neutrality.
So let's be concrete. If we take Ukraine, on one side we have an Elon Musk who owns Starlink and X/Twitter, and he geofences Starlink so that it can't be used on Crimea.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that ICRC should stop using Twitter?
That's a very complicated question. I really don't have an answer to that. I think that's probably a shortcut and a difficult question, but I think it's not useless to ask the question and to be just like, whoa, hold on. We used to use that technical tool as it was, but now we realize it's very heavily politically connotated. In some countries, it's forbidden. So if we use in some countries but cannot use it in others, should we continue to use it? Is it going to be, are we going to be perceived as neutral if we do that? Do we have a choice? I'm not sure we have a choice. So we become hostages of the politicization of technology. And then we come back to the problem is like, what alternative do we have? Can we continue to operate at scale and all of this without those technologies? No. Are we in control of the fact that they belong to a few companies and a few individuals? Absolutely not. Do we, can we, and so ideally, I would say, yeah, there's an alternative. Build your own tech, build humanitarian tech. And that would be fantastic. But how do you do that? You need funds, you need technologies.
You need and you just told us not to waste our money innovating, right? So I mean, so we can't really. Right? But because, and it's serious, right? Because you can take Microsoft and the role they played in helping the Ukrainian government evacuate all the data into the cloud before the full-scale conflict. I mean, does that mean that we can't have PCs and Microsoft operating system on ICC computers or on ACAP's computer? What are the implications?
Exactly. That's where what is emerging and coming to us, and we're waking up. I think we are not behind at the ICRC in thinking about that. We have been thinking about that for years. That's also why we set up a delegation, so-called delegation to the cyberspace, which is actually based in Luxembourg, which is dedicated to think about these things and to try to see where and if we can do R&D ourselves to manage those tensions and those dependencies that we have. Yes, we are independent, but we are not independent. We're always dependent on many things. We depend on donors for money, on people for access and trust and all of this. And we also depend on technology to do our work and to do it at scale. So that dependency is becoming problematic because it used to not come with such a heavy political baggage. And now it's there. And when tech companies that you are depending on actually take position for one side versus the other, yeah, that creates problems of perception. It's not enough to be neutral and independent. You need to be perceived as such. So what does it say when we come with a whole armada of technological tool that may be perceived by local communities or mostly local authorities as, oh, you are not on the right side because of your tech tools? Well, we need to pay attention to this. And then there are also other factors, and one of them is the increasing use of sanctions in the technological domains. So when you see the EU or the US taking measures against particular tech companies in China or something like this, that restricts our ability to choose and to do these things. And so the fragmentation of the digital landscape at the political level will turn into something at the operational level. How are we going to navigate this? It will become a nightmare. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's not too early to have a discussion about this and to talk to those responsible, which are tech companies and states, and say, hey, how are we going to, you know, make sure that all of you doing at the political level, we understand that's your problem, not ours, but we don't want it to affect our ability to do our mission and to do it the way we should do it, which is in line with the fundamental principles. So all these problems are emerging. They're coming to our face and we are a little bit overwhelmed, but we can't give up. We have no choice. We can't give up. That's why we need to think. And that's where we need to think critically. And that's where I think the humanitarian principles are helpful for us to do this. It's not to find solutions. It's to anticipate the problem, to prepare, to think, and to try to build solutions as we move forward.
And when it comes to neutrality, the main issue you see is around the shifting role of tech companies as they become incredibly powerful and have this direct impact on conflict that we see. That we, by association, then are tainted by that.
That there is a risk that we are not tainted by that. We are not tainted by, you know, a particular tech company, of which we use the services or product, taking a stand on a conflict. That's not our decision. We are not tainted by that. But there is a risk that our perception will be tainted by that, and that could lead to problems. And that's what we want to prevent and mitigate. So let's do that right now. Let's talk about it so that we don't run into those problems.
Great.
Independence. So independence, it's closely linked to neutrality, because it's that where we are. We should not be seen or perceived as being associated with particular political agendas. And then we come back to the question of technology being a tool for politics as well, a tool for power. And so we need to navigate those things. And I think to me, there's also, so now I'm making a little bit of a stretch with the principle of independence. But I think in practice, how do you measure independence? Is when you are able to take your own decisions, to decide how you do things and how you organize your operations to achieve your own objectives. And so, and I think nowadays we come back to what we discussed at the beginning, we are more and more dependent on technology to do these things. And so that dependency, when a technology is politically connotated, if you use it, so for instance, it could be said, AI is a tool for neoliberalism, for neocapitalism. Some people see that or conceive that. So if we use AI, are we going to be perceived by those people as neoliberal, capitalist, and things like this? I don't know, maybe, but we need to do this. We need to think about this. And when it also reduces its our ability to be... So for instance, we depend on connectivity nowadays. If you don't have connectivity, most people can communicate because they use smartphone. Most people can transmit data back to HQ and all of this kind of, and all of these kind of problems. But we know connectivity is also become a huge political issue. I mean, look at the number of internet shutdowns we see everywhere, in particular in places where we work, Sudan, Myanmar, and many others. And so when we depend on something that has become so politicized, we threaten our own ability to operate autonomously. And if you shut down the internet, can we run our operations? Probably, because we have backups and stuff. But is it always going to be the case? I don't know. And if we don't have that operational autonomy, can we really consider ourselves as independent? So again, it's all adding complexity to the interpretation and the implementation of the fundamental principles that we need to realize. It comes with technology. There's no other choice. We don't have perfect solutions right now, but we absolutely have a duty to ask ourselves the questions, because there's a risk in really ignoring them and keep moving forward at full speed, as we have seen in the sector for the past few years. And I find this very dangerous. I use the expression, it's a little bit, but we've been binging on technology. And I'm very afraid that we could have a massive digital hangover if we continue to do that without being more responsible. So yes, let's do like with drinking, let's be responsible.
Pierrick, thank you for coming on Trumanitarian. It is so nice to have a conversation with somebody who is a bit of a Luddite, I guess. I don't think you're insulted by that label, who is careful with the political implications of technology, who doesn't just jump at the new shiny app or portal or whatever, but really tries to very carefully and deliberately think through what is technology doing to us and what can we do to technology to be better humanitarians, to have a better impact, to be more principled in the way we act. I wish we had more thinking like what you have presented today in the sector, because I do think that we are a bit too much on autopilot, at least for my comfort. So thank you for taking us back to basics and for coming on to Trumanitarian.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation. I think the fact that you invited me to discuss about this shows that it's not hopeless and that we can start and have those conversations. So yeah, let's get to work and let's do better.
It's about the rights and the freedom to be, for people to choose their path in life and dream. Souls of men beyond what you see. Stages are different for each, who will lead? Cycles of outsiders that get fat checks, fly in, fly out of places with slums and jets. Ask better questions, pick apart, educate, and no one is safe. We're here to build and debate. We are searching for more. Open up your mind beyond rich or poor. For the truth, you've been warned. Trumanitarian.